Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. Today on the episode, I had the pleasure to talk to Phil Gerbyshack, Chief Digital Officer and co-founder of Vengresso. It's basically the place you go to learn how to use your digital equipment, software, social media, LinkedIn, your phone to the best of its ability. You know, as Phil points out, we only use about 10% of everything that we possibly could use. So how could you use it better? That's what they do. And Phil and I had just an amazing conversation. And what's funny about this episode is that Phil is going to put this on his podcast, Conversations with Phil. And we kind of did a co-branded episode here to have fun, shits and giggles, really, at the end of the day. So today on the episode, Phil Gerbyshack, Chief Digital Officer of Vengresso and podcast host of Conversations with Phil. So check that out. It's on C-Suite Network. So him and I are not really partners, but we're on the same network together. It was a fantastic conversation. Also want to remind you, I want to hear about your crucible. So go to my website, drjameskelly.com, K-E-L-L-E-Y. And leave your story there. And I'll share it on the podcast. Also, you will start to notice I have shrunk the podcast. I have given up. I have tried to do an hour-long podcast for a long time. My numbers plateaued. And so I am bending to the will of the masses at this point, and I'm doing 30 minutes or less, or at least close to 30 minutes. But good news, the full podcast, because I cannot stop doing the hour-long podcast, will be on my website at drjameskelly.com. So go there, check it out. If you like the new format, go to iTunes and leave me a review, please. And finally, I leave in 4 days for New York to go to the C-Suite book studio, TV studio, whatever the studio is called, to do my little short interview that will go out to the world the first of the year. So I'm pretty excited about that. And my book is out for review. So that is done as well. So get some feedback on that. And yeah, man, that's it. So hey, listen, you all have a great week. Phil, thanks. Doug Sandler, we call you out on this. So if you haven't listened to Doug's show, The Nice Guys on Business, check that out. It is also on C-Suite, iTunes, and Overcast.fm, which is where my show is at as well. So if you're on Overcast.fm, by all means, click the star. Just hit the star, just one star. I will shamelessly ask you to hit the star just one time. All right, everyone. Have a happy Monday. See you.
Hey, what's up, everyone? This is an extra special conversation with Phil. This is Phil Gerbyshack coming to you live and in color from Tampa, Florida. With me is Dr. James Kelly. James, what's up, dude?
Hey, man. Welcome to Executive After Hours with Dr. James Kelly.
Holy crap. So this is like a doubleheader. You know, like I'm going to be playing shortstop and pitching this game, I think. I'm not really sure, though.
I'm usually bat boy and the guy who rakes the field in between innings.
Sweet. We've got it all covered. If we just had a concessionaire, where the hell is Doug Sandler when you need him? Right. To sell some hot dogs. Come on, Dougie.
I mean, seriously, have you listened to his podcast? How much do they sell for the first 15 minutes now?
I think it's 30 minutes and 15 minutes. It's really incredible, actually. Yep.
So, well, listen, thanks for entertaining this idea of doing, and this will be the biggest challenge for both of us, is not to dominate the conversation because we're so used to hosting our own show. So I really think it's awesome that we're doing this kind of cross-promo,
for both of us. I mean, I think it's just a great way to do it because you and I are very similar. We're all about just conversations and who are the people deep down, not what you do. Can I share with you the tagline that I have for my my show?
Oh, come on. Yeah, absolutely. Tagline for Executive After Hours Podcast is...
I don't care what you do. It's only who you are because who you are defines what you do.
Yeah, that's perfect, man. Yeah, I feel the same way. I think, you know, it all is about who you are and why. I would include why you do what you do, because that really does help us understand the work that you do, because that's the common thread that flows through everything.
So then starting this off, then we kind of go back and forth here, but wherever you want to go, but like you're in Tampa, yep. I'm in the UAE, so Middle East. How long have you been in Tampa?
I've been in Tampa now, let's see, 2 years, 2 months, and 15 days.
Not the year county, but where were you before that?
So I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I know, hold on, now I know this date because it's the 15th and I moved on the 1st of June. That's how I know exactly what date it is, right? So that's, you know, I'm not good at math usually, but it does happen to be the 15th when we're recording this.
So wait, why did you move?
Dude, have you been to Wisconsin in the wintertime? Come on, man. Yeah,
but it's good people.
Sure it is. No, I love the people in Milwaukee. Do not be fooled, James. I love my friends back in Milwaukee. I don't love 8 months of winter. Why are you in the UAE, brother?
Well, I think, you know, life is short. I've got 4 Thanes that I've spawned via my wife. And so I think that these Thanes could be an anomaly. But my children, I want them to experience something other than the U.S. And
yeah.
So since we're playing the volley game, let me ask you a question here.
Yeah.
In Tampa, right? So first of all, if you grew up in Milwaukee,
I did.
Milwaukee, you said?
I did say I was in Milwaukee. I spent 20 years in Milwaukee, but I moved from a little town called Crivitz, population 996, where, you know, we didn't have any people of color. We didn't have any diversity. And it was really weird. I mean, you want to talk about biases? Holy crap. I mean, I just went back there for my 25th class reunion. And it just reminds me, you know, some people, when they say, you know, making America great again, some people still live in 1975. And it actually kind of makes me
scary.
Kind of, yeah, it's scary and it's sad. And I say that to you intentionally moved away. Some people either don't have the opportunity, don't take the opportunity, or whatever. Some people never leave those little itty-bitty
They intentionally
towns.
Stay.
Yeah, they intentionally stay. And that's, you know, that's great if that's their life. The challenge comes when they're faced with some adversity and then they're like, okay, now what? This isn't exactly what I expected. Now what do I do? Or somebody that's different thinking than they are comes in. And so it is scary. If you don't choose change chooses you. And that's really scary for a lot of people.
So when you're at this class reunion, like, what was the first thing you thought because you're walking around?
So I graduated the class of 50 people. We only had 15 at the class reunion. So honestly, it was just like, hey, you know, this, it's fun to see all these people in second. Holy crap, can these people drink? Because we were, you know, my buddy owns a bar. So one of the guys that I went to high school with owns a bar, a tavern, whatever you want to call it, and a place called Loopy's. And so, yeah, so we went there and, you know, I just realized I don't drink that much anymore. As much as, you know, I'm not telling you I don't have a drink now and then. I'm not a teetotaler, but certainly I don't drink that often. And my tolerance, holy crap, you know, when I was 25, I could probably, you know, tranking me was like tranking an elephant. I could drink. Well, now it's like 2 drinks and I'm like, dude, what is my name?
But when you were there though, like, you know, so I just had my 25th reunion. I didn't go, but there was pictures posted and, you know, I try not to judge, but we're human beings. Like if you're being honest, like really good human beings don't judge. And man, I have so much respect for these people, but I'm looking at these photos and to your point, so many of them have never left the same zip code and it just frightened the hell out of me to think about. You know, you're talking to somebody who's lived in 3 different countries, right? So my perspective is probably totally skewed to the liberal biased left. You know, I mean, I'm not a total tree hugger. I'm probably like liberal socially, but conservative fiscally, if that was the, if I was to define myself.
Libertarian, yeah.
And so I see these individuals and I just think to myself, what are you doing? Like, I don't know. I felt like such an asshole as I was judging, but.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, that's fair. And I do ask, like, I have asked them, like, how have you never left? Like, is there no interest to move? What is, you know, what's the deal? And I guess.
What do they say? Like, yeah. What do they say?
Well, some of them, you know, there's no reason to move. Like, everything they want is there. They don't want anymore. And I think that's, fascinating to me. I'd love to tell you that I'm not judgmental too, but you know, I don't understand that. And I'm like, really? Like, you don't want to see that? And actually some of my friends, you know, they want to go back there. And so I don't know if that's the Al Bundy syndrome, like where people want to relive their glory years, or if that's just, you know, times are hard now. And I will say, man, it sometimes really sucks being an adult, right? Where I've got to work my butt off to make it work. Heck yeah, man. I would love to be 16 again, making $650, $750 an hour, and that was living wage. That's not true anymore. I mean, that's just, that's not possible. I would need like four roommates to make that work.
You know, it's funny when you say that, because like when I was teaching in Philadelphia before I moved out here, I was teaching at a Catholic university. And I would have this conversation with students like, all right, what's minimum wage? I think it was like 780 or whatever it was. And then I'm like, well, how many of you guys think that's enough to live off of? And hands would go up. I'm like, oh, okay. So I start doing the math, right? And I'd say, I think like 780 is like $1,400 a month or something roughly like that, 1415. I said, okay, well, if you're going to live in the Philadelphia proper, your rent's going to be at least five or six. So that's half your money gone. Do you have a car? Yes. Do you have payments? Yes. How much? $100 a month. Okay, great. That's another 100. Hey, gas is going to be about 100. So there you go. Are you going to eat? All right. So start doing the math and they're like, holy shit. I'm like, exactly. Like the amount of money people at the lower end of the economic scale make is so far short of what they need to live that they got to work a second job, which means they can never get ahead because they always have to be working. So they can never give themselves the education or training to transition themselves to a different lifestyle or a different career or whatever.
Yeah.
It's sad. So then where did you end up doing your university work?
So I went 3.5 years to UW-Milwaukee. I was a Panther 3.5 years. I dropped out of school. I got bored. I got a job in sales, and then I got another job in sales, this time as a stockbroker, and found out that if I didn't have a degree, I was never, ever, ever going to get promoted there. And then 9/11 happened, and I said, wow, I got to go back into IT, which is what I did in the Navy. You know, I delivered email by hand. So then the internet became real suddenly in 2001 because I was trading stocks online. That was my job back before Scottrade and E-Trade and all those fancy trading systems. My team and I figured out how to set up an automated review and release system. I had some of the smartest people on the planet that I worked with that we came up with this. And then I went back in IT. Became a VP of IT, got my bachelor's degree actually in computer science, but get this, a bachelor of arts. So I can draw programs. I just can't write.
So, hey, so let me do, you know, at least in my show, I have a short segment that I love to do because it helps kind of support my book a little bit.
Yeah, hit me, man.
And so, the segment is called Let's Get Authentic, and I'm going to ask you essentially five, depending on how you answer, six questions. So are you ready to do the old Let's Get the Fuck Authentic?
Absolutely. Hit me with your best shot.
All right. So these are more introspective questions. So question one is, you know, when you think about leadership, you know, and these are all leadership questions, by the way. When you think about leadership, one of the key attributes of leadership and being a successful leader, and I think authentic leader, is self-awareness. So what do you do to increase or help or enhance your self-awareness?
Wow. So to increase mine, well, first of all, my girlfriend is really good at telling me where I'm good and where I can use improvement. So that's really helpful. She's a good mirror for me.
Feedback.
Yeah, feedback is really big. And then just paying attention and really reading what I write and examining what I think. It is, you know, it changes from day to day. The recent stuff in, you know, in Charlottesville really made me examine what I'm posting on Facebook and why I'm posting it. And am I posting it for approval? Am I posting it because I want applause? Or am I posting it because I want to take my platform and make a difference? And the answer, I mean, honestly, is all of the above. But sometimes I need to focus more on the making an impact than I do about the applause. So, you know, that constant examination, I read things from a lot of different sources, James. Mm-hmm. I don't just read, you know, the normal things, the mm-hmm. you know, the Wall Street Journal and stuff. And then I think about it. And I think that helps me a lot.
That's awesome. All right. Question two. So, you know, the overview of my book is really this idea of this model. And one of the major things is the crucible, which we talked about. And, you know, one of your crucibles will be married three times. Right, each one of those is a moment in your life that's kind of given you pause. And then I say, okay, well, now you've had the crucible. Let's be more self-aware from that crucible, because if you have the ability to be reflective, you should grow as a human being. And as you grow, one of the things that you find with these leaders that I've interviewed, these authentic leaders, is that they actually increase their integrity, right? So how do you practice integrity? And there's two types of integrity. There's the moral integrity and there's the behavioral integrity. But as you've gotten older and wiser and more distinguished and handsome, how has your integrity shifted, right? Like, how have you grown your integrity or practice integrity even? You can even answer it that way.
Hmm. Good questions. And thanks for noticing my rugged good looks. I appreciate that, James. That's always nice when another man does that. That's makes me feel really squishy inside, like I want to puke. Yeah. Thanks. as far as, you know, growing integrity, again, I think so much of that is just about taking a pause and thinking, you know, is this really the right thing to do?
Do you have a mantra you use for that?
I don't. I wish I did. It's really just, you know, just pause, just think about it, you know, and would maybe it's, you know, would my best self do this? I don't really know. It's just about pause. I don't really, you know, I don't really say anything. I don't have anything written.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, it is. Mm. But pause helps a lot. Because with pause comes space, and with space, I think, comes discernment. And discernment then leads to integrity.
That's awesome. All right. Question three. So the other side of this in terms of growth is this idea of compassion, right? And so people confuse compassion with empathy all the time. So just to kind of clearly define compassion for you, compassion is not only feeling how someone feels, but it's also the almost guttural instinct to relieve their suffering. Now, the word suffering is kind of this loaded thing of like some major event, but it could be that I spilled coffee on my pants and you just get me a new coffee, right? I'm suffering. So do you feel like you're a compassionate person? And if so, how do you practice that?
Yeah, I do. I know that I haven't always been.
But I hear it in you though. I hear it in you.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, yeah. I think, you know, again, that comes with time and that comes with pause. And it comes from understanding that not everybody is like me. When I went to school to be a teacher, I initially thought that I wanted to be a teacher because I wanted the kids to be just like me. And that seems kind of, you know, like self-serving. And certainly at the time, it wasn't meant to be, but my instructor, Dr. Choya Wilson, challenged me and said, Phil, how about making the kids their best selves instead of wanting to be like you? And she challenged that. And, you know, to your point about a crucible moment, I remember that was the first B that I ever got in a paper in college. And she said, that's just, you know, that's not going to work. And if you don't change that attitude, you're never, ever going to make any difference because everybody wants to be themselves. And the compassion piece, as I work.
And you're disappointed because then they're not being like you. So there's this disconnect that happens. Sorry,
that's right. Yeah, no, totally. Absolutely correct. And so as a student teacher in the inner city in Milwaukee, if I wanted kids to be like me, well, first of all, many of them were children of color. I'm white. They can't be like me. Okay. Yeah. Second of all, many of those kids, while they came from similar backgrounds to mine, I was, you know, very poor. My mom was a waitress, made $1.61 an hour. My stepdad worked at the Bargain Barn, making $5.50 an hour. My dad was a dairy farmer forever. I don't even know that he ever filed a positive tax return. So it was really, you know, I got that. Like, I got the poor factor, but I also then at first didn't have much compassion why these kids can't just pull themselves up with their bootstraps and be better. And then I realized they're not like me. So that happened really strong. And I think that's just continued over the years as I've surrounded myself with a very purposefully diverse group of friends. I have, you know, as a professional speaker and part of the National Speaker Association, I have friends that talk on just about every topic. Some friends who their topic is they've been paralyzed because of an accident. They've lost limbs because of something. I know people who are that have burned 99% of their body, people who all sorts of different ways that they're special.
Doesn't it just put your life in perspective?
And
like, what am I really bitching about?
Dude, I'm so lucky. Like, yeah. Really, I'm so fortunate to be who I am. And I think, you know, again, I didn't have that, man. 20 years ago, if you'd have asked me this question, I'd be like, compassion, dude, just work harder. Come on, man, you can do this. Yeah. And now it's like, wow, I guess you do have some disadvantages that I didn't have. And I didn't even think about that. And it's been a, you know, it's an ongoing journey. I don't think that I'm perfect at all. I know that I still have a long, long way to go. And I hope that I continue to learn and continue to grow and continue to have more compassion.
Awesome. All right. Two quick questions. And then you've got to bounce and I've got to bounce.
Yeah.
Question four. You know, one of the other things about, I think, an authentic leader that really stood out to me while I was writing this book, and you demonstrate this amazingly, is the idea to be relatable, right? So I call it relatableness, which there's always a red squiggly line underneath it. So I don't feel like that's a real word, but I use it as a verb. And what I mean by that is that people who I think are authentic leaders really go out of their way to actively engage with people and relate with them. And so one of the things that I found with some of the most like authentic and most relatable people is they came from pretty poor, basic environments. And as they moved up the ranks in society, meaning like made more money, higher positions, you know, better themselves professionally, they were able to then relate to people from all different parts of the organization. And so is there something that you do when you meet new people that is a tactic that you use to relate with them right away?
Well, I don't know. I think I pay a lot of attention and I look them in the eyes, and a lot of times actually I'm a hugger. I hug people and I hug them from my heart. And I mean, you know, there's nothing sexual about it. There is nothing like smarmy about it. I mean it.
You don't have to defend it. Like, I get it.
But I have to explain it though. Cause you get it. Cause we've just spent an hour together, but a lot of people that hear that, they're like, that's, you're kind of in my space. And the other thing, I used to do that to everybody. Now I'm okay with not doing it to everybody. I actually had a friend of mine who I really admire said, dude, that just really makes me uncomfortable. And that's cool. But I think those kind of, those three things, right? I look people in the eyes. I hug them if they're comfortable with that. And then I just, you know, I'm fully present, man. I don't look at my phone. I don't look.
That's a big one.
I don't have a watch. I'm there. And I think that really helps because I don't want to be relatable to them. I think they want to be relatable to me. And by that, I mean, people want to share their story, man. They just want to be heard. So I don't need to try to be relatable. I just need to be present. And they'll share with me what they're comfortable with. And then I'm just there with it.
I mean, that's a huge point, by the way, that I think it's really undervalued is that, you know, one of the biggest things to do when you meet someone new, I do a couple different things. One, as I usually ask like 3 to 5 questions about them to get them talking. So I can find some sort of story that we might relate with right away. Like, oh yeah, that's same with me. And like, oh, we're bonding. The other thing I always do with people that I, if I've known them once or twice before, like chit chatted, I put my hand on their shoulder and just kind of squeeze lightly, like, yeah, like in a big smiley face to like show that I'm with them. Like I'm here to have a conversation, not in, obviously same as you, not in a sexual way, but like, you know, shake their hands, hand on the shoulder, like, yeah, so nice to see you again and blah, blah, blah. And then same, like the biggest thing you said, which I think is so important and so lost. And I'm sure if you go to a party or you're at a conference, and I get so fucking angry at this, is that you'll be talking to somebody and you see their eyes darting around the room and you're like, No, seriously, I'm right here. Like, right here. And I said, I remember I was at a conference once and I said this to somebody. I said, listen, I understand you're trying to like talk to certain people for a job. I get that. Just say to me, I apologize. I need to talk to this person because of this reason. But don't talk to me and see your eyes going all over the place and you're not actually listening to me because you're just saying, And I get so angry about that. All right. Sorry. Last question. You also alluded to this one earlier a little bit, but I think the other thing that really stuck with me is this idea of a growth mindset. Now, if you're not familiar with Carol Dweck, she wrote the books on mindset, growth mindset, fixed mindset. And essentially she said that really successful leaders had this idea of growth mindset, meaning they're always trying to learn about themselves and others. They take accountability when there's mistakes. They want to learn from those mistakes, but they're always about moving forward in their life and in their career. So what do you do to grow from a learning perspective?
Well, first of all, I am looking at Carol Dweck's book right now. It is right next to my desk every single day. And so are many books. So that's the first thing I do is I read voraciously. I love to read books. I seldom, sadly, finish books, but I love to read books.
The good news with that book is there's only about 4 chapters you need to read. So
good. Well, that's good. So yeah, but any book, right? I think that you can always learn something from a book. So secondly, is having a podcast means I get to talk to smart people like you, James. I get to learn from people like you. I get to ask questions, or sometimes the roles are reversed and they get to ask questions of me, which then either helps me learn about you or helps me learn about me. Either way, I think I win. And then last but not least, that is, I am an endless practitioner. I am always practicing my craft. Anything that I tell you to do, I'm going to at least try. Now, sometimes I suck and I fail. And sometimes I'm pretty good at it. And sometimes I give up before I get good at it. And sometimes it just sucks in general and I don't do it. But I'm always trying and I'm always, you know, practicing and I'm always trying to be better. I coach, I speak, I train, I live from a place of constant practice. And I never pretend like I'm the best at anything because I know no matter how good I am at anything, I know there's probably at least one person in the world better than me and I want to be better than them. So that keeps me going, man. That keeps me growing. And then lastly, I really, really listen to people that have been where I've been. And I ask them questions. When I show up at an NSA event, the National Speaker Association, there's so many smart people. When I'm on a podcast with someone like you, usually we always get a few minutes to talk about each other and to learn from each other. And that's so precious to me. And so, my calendar is full, but it's open. And by that, I mean, it's full. I'm busy, man, but I always make time to grow. I always make time to learn. And I always make time to connect with people that are smarter than me. And I think that's pretty much everybody in the world. I'm happy to talk.
I think, thank you for that playing. Let's get authentic.
So what do you want? I know we got to wrap up here, James, but you've asked me a ton of questions, man. The one thing I got to know from you is, right, you're writing this authentic leader book. What is the biggest surprise that you've encountered from all the people you've talked to and all the writing that you've done that you're going to share with us in this book?
It's the role a crucible plays in defining certain individuals, whatever that DNA is, right? So there were women that I interviewed. There was a woman particularly that I interviewed who, her name is Bridget Mayer. And she's forever just burned on my mind. She was raised in a crack house until she was about 9, having to drink out of a toilet bowl because she couldn't reach the sink, not having food, being beaten and put in the hospital, who gets adopted at 9, her and her 2 other sisters, one was older, one was younger. And she makes it out to be a multimillionaire by owning art galleries, right? She ends up going to college, and her 2 sisters struggle with addiction their whole life. How the fuck does this person who has this massive crucible have the DNA to make the choices to get themselves to be who they are and own their past, use their past to be a better person? And the only thing I came up with is a sandwich. And what I mean by that is that people use their crucible to develop a growth mindset. And in doing that, that allowed them to increase their self-awareness, compassion, integrity, and relatableness to those around them, because they're creating shared meaning, trying to relieve suffering of those around them at the same time. And it's just, it was a really just empowering, impactful moment of awe. It's a really cool book. I interweave excerpts from the individuals that I've interviewed demonstrating compassion, integrity, crucibles, and what that meant to them and how that actually helps define their authenticity and their growth into this idea of a learning or growth mindset.
Awesome. I can't wait to read it, man. That sounds great, James.
Me too.
Cool. Cool, dude.
So listen, thank you. I'm gonna do my signature sign off. Thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to stop by Executive After Hours and engage in this just awesome chat.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Thank you for sharing a bit of yourself as well. And we will definitely do this again, James. Thanks, buddy.
Awesome.
Hey, how good was that, right? It was like a dual smash mouth thing. Anyhow, remember, go to our website, drjameskelly.com. Upload, what is your crucible? What do you want the audience to know about your trials and tribulations? And I'll share your story on my podcast. All right. Have an awesome week, everybody. Remember, leave a review on iTunes.